most people don't figure this out until maybe startup number two or three, right? When you first dip your toe into this tech world, you really don't know what to expect. And again, a lot of startups are different in terms of culture, how they operate.
This is Retained Learnings, a podcast where Canadian finance leaders share strategic advice and potential solutions to answer some of the finance department's most important questions. I'm your host, Rob Kazam, the founder and CEO of Float. Thanks for listening, and I hope you learned something from today's episode.
Today, I'm excited to sit down with Aman Samra, VP Finance at Spellbook, a company that is bringing assistive AI to lawyers. Aman also runs a tech-based podcast called Generation Hustle, which we'll link to in the show notes. So Aman, welcome. I'm always interested to learn what makes people choose certain career paths. What led you to choosing a career in finance and accounting?
Yeah, well, Rob, first off, thanks so much for having me on the show. We alluded to this earlier. It's interesting to be the interviewee rather than the interviewer. So hopefully your audience loves what I have to say. In terms of just like the career path towards tech, I think I have kind of a traditional path as most finance folks would in terms of how they start off. So start off in accounting firms, top six firms, big six, big four. And I think for a career in finance, you really do need a great foundation. And obviously those accounting firms are a great way to learn how financial statements work, how tax work, how different distributions work. So I spent about 3 years there, got that foundation, but ultimately I felt long-term, I didn't want to pursue a career in public accounting. So private companies and kind of at that point in time, this was about probably 2017, tech was really taking off, especially becoming really popular in Toronto. Bitcoin and all this kind of blockchain technology was all there. And so I was just like, hey, let me start like exploring this. There might be something here in terms of a career. I didn't really have any exposure to SF. We'll get to that later. But there's a lot of interesting kind of stories and kind of articles that came out during that time. And so I started searching. Eventually, I landed at a B2B enterprise security company that would sell like large security software to like data centers and stuff like to Facebook, Cisco, stuff like that. So I think that was a really interesting time where I was the first finance hire, absolutely had no idea what I was doing when I first came in and what the expectations were. And I think the challenge is like, you know, you go from accounting to less of accounting and more operations related roles. And I think that was kind of the driver for me to stay within startup. So ultimately, I what I did was help them with their operations, their infrastructure, worked quite a bit on some of their large deals and strategy. After a short stint there, about 2.5 years, I went to another Toronto-based startup called Sampler. They were a marketplace company for sampling. And so unfortunately, due to COVID, that role didn't last too long. And so that had me exploring. Eventually, I started doing some freelance work. And one of my friends down south, he had convinced me to start exploring and thinking about working out in SF. There's a lot of companies. Tech is kind of the area where they focus in on. And so, you know, I was like, hey, let me just take a shot here. Eventually found a role at a fintech, very early stage, seed round. And I spent 2.5 years there, helped them raise a bunch of funding, you know, first finance hire, operationalize the entire stack. And so that's kind of what led me down eventually to this leadership position. I wanted to kind of help support the Canadian ecosystem again. Spent 2.5 years in the US, learned quite a bit in terms of how they operate, how, you know, companies scale and grow in the US comparatively to Canada. But I think I was super excited about what Scott, Matt, and Danny were building at Spellbook. And honestly, I just wanted to build another success story in Canada, especially within AI. So that landed me a role at Spellbook, where I'm now VP of Finance. And so Spellbook is the leading generative AI solution for lawyers out in the market. And yeah, that's kind of my background and how I enter tech.
Amazing range of experience, lots to get into. Interesting that unlike many of the guests that I've had on in the past, you didn't spend that long in the accounting field. You chose to work pretty early in your career with fast-growing startups. And I'm curious on reflection, what is it about startups that appealed and appeals to you as a finance professional that pulled you in earlier in your career?
Yeah, I think one of the traits that I've been told by a lot of folks is this insatiable appetite for curiosity. And I think that's something that really lends itself to working in a startup. And so while I was working in private or public accounting, the workload is pretty much the same every single day, and you're doing something, a mundane task, right? You're either working on an audit, pretty much the same thing, just a different company. You're working on tax, which is a pretty much the same thing for a different client. So over time, that just really just kind of wore on me in terms of, do I really want to do this for the rest of my life and not kind of really learn and grow? Because there's a lot of opportunity out there. I think with startups specifically, and why I wanted to join early on is, again, that curiosity, like what is out there? And what is it like to work at an early stage company where, you know, stuff isn't, it's pretty ambiguous. It's not solved. And, you know, you have an opportunity to make an impact, and you actually have an opportunity to influence decisions, which that is something I kind of look forward to when I work in a specific environment. And so knowing that, I knew I couldn't do that in a typical corporate setting. And so that's kind of why I started exploring startup quite early on. Again, I could have landed at another corporate company, a large conglomerate, whatever. But that's not kind of where, you know, large decisions are made or you really have influence. So, you know, the other thing I would say is like within finance specifically, an early stage company, you're exposed to a lot of teams. And the benefit of that is you learn quite a bit from other stakeholders on kind of what is driving their decisions. So I'm now more aware of what a marketing leader needs, what a sales leader needs, why product makes the decisions that they do. So I think you're better equipped to really support companies longer term because you're kind of that Swiss Army knife individual rather than, you know, I've spent 10 years in audit and that's kind of just my specific tool set. So that's kind of my main reasons that curiosity and kind of wanting to lead and influence decision making, which I feel like is also a trait like a lot of millennials have. Just wanting to partake in that.
Love it. All about obviously impact learning. Great reasons to be in a fast growing startup. What do you, you know, you've typically worked with startups from C to series B. As I went through your background, you've been, I believe, the first finance hire at three different companies. So you've got some experience with this. What do you look for when choosing a company to join, especially a startup? What are the qualities that you want to see to have the confidence to jump in as the first finance hire?
Yeah, I would caveat this with the fact that most people don't figure this out until maybe startup number two or three, right? When you first dip your toe into this tech world, you really don't know what to expect. And again, a lot of startups are different in terms of culture, how they operate, whatnot. This is my fourth startup, third time being first finance hire. So these are kind of the three things I would personally look at now if I'm evaluating a startup. The first thing is really the leadership team. Are they well equipped to understand kind of what they're building? And do they have a deep understanding of the tech? You don't want someone to kind of be leading the project and have it no kind of influence or understanding of how they build it, why they're doing it. I think you also need to understand if those founders or even leadership team have done this multiple times. There is a stat out there, I don't know the percentage exactly, that second time founders or, you know, third time founders have a lot more success than say a first time founder. And so, you know, assessing that is an important skill set to have and just seeing what level of passion or experience that they have. Because it does solve a lot of issues that typically a lot of people don't see within a startup in terms of the decision-making processes. I think the next one is really thinking big. A part of the culture assessment that I like to run personally is like, how big is this team thinking? Are we just kind of isolated and kind of thinking, oh, we're going to be successful in the Canadian ecosystem and that's about it? Or are we like really going to be global? And if I were to kind of look at my process when I was evaluating Spellbook, one of the questions I asked Scott was, what do you want to be? Do you guys want to be the next great Canadian company or the next great global company? There hasn't really been too many successes coming out of Canada. I think the name that usually everyone talks about is Shopify. And so it's, hey, like, can we be the next Shopify, which is a global brand? And so immediately when he said that, I was just like, okay, they're thinking big. This is not going to be just that kind of let's build it up to, I don't know, $10 million ARR, sell it, and that's it. Story's done. So I think thinking big is a huge thing. The last thing is, I would say industry. So for me personally, as a finance person or in general, in working in startup, you do want to kind of grow as, you know, tech grows and there's an advent of new technologies. So for me, I was particularly interested in working in this AI space. Now, that does not come with the expectations of me becoming this technical expert within AI. I'm not going to be coding or any of that. But having the foundational kind of knowledge of how these companies work and how they influence your kind of day-to-day or what they're going to be doing in the future across different workflows or even your day-to-day life is an incredibly valuable skill set to have. And so knowing that, that's kind of a particular thing that was important to me. And so I would say, yeah, industry, how big is this company thinking? And is that leadership team really equipped to help scale this business or kind of what they're actually solving? Outside of that, it's going to be a lot of challenges internally, which you're just going to have to solve. And there's going to be a bunch of surprises. So it's really hard to evaluate that unless you're in the weeds. But in general, on the surface, those are the kind of things I would talk about or assess.
Lots of great wisdom shared. If there's a common mistake that you see people making, looking to jump into a startup for the first time, what do you think it is?
I'll give it from the context of maybe a finance person first, and then maybe more general. So I think the biggest mistake a new finance hire makes is they go into this idea that, you know, everything is already set up and it's ready to run in terms of how a typical corporate system would or a corporate company would run, right? So they have all their systems set up in a way where it's well designed and you're really just doing kind of the day-to-day operations. Whereas as soon as you enter an early stage startup, they're actually looking at you to kind of fix all of these issues. And they don't really have that leader or kind of understanding or technical knowledge of that finance function to kind of build that stack per se. And so I've come across a lot of finance folks who come from a very traditional background, stick themselves into a early stage company, and then they're really overwhelmed with kind of what they see because they've never seen this. And so I think, it, again, it lends to this idea of also being curious and how to solve things. So I would say like startups generally are really best suited for folks that have that kind of ability to learn and adapt really quickly. It's not for everyone. And so that's a similar mistake I made when I joined my second startup as like kind of the first finance hire, having thought that, you know, some of the stuff that would have been existing at my first startup would have already been there. And I was really, really overwhelmed early on, but eventually solving all that. But it did slow down my progress for like 3 to 4 months, which in startup world is quite a bit of time. And so that's one thing I'd say with finance folks specifically, like do expect challenges to come and don't expect everything to work and make sure you understand kind of what you're getting yourself into. So do ask those questions when you interview. And that's something I've just learned over time, right? In terms of just general folks, when it comes to picking a startup, I think there's always this fear around how well capitalized a company is or how well they're doing. As you kind of know, like we're not in this ZERP environment anymore. So it's really hard to come across capital. Scaling is much harder. And a lot of these companies that were like darlings back in 2021, 2022 are now really struggling to stay afloat. So I would say for a lot of folks that want to join tech and kind of want to join a company, make sure you're ready to expect perhaps the company failing, perhaps you know, getting laid off is something that can happen. Just make sure you do your due diligence in terms of where they're at and how they're doing. Because the last thing you want to do is ruin the chance of kind of managing your day-to-day life for the kind of chance to work at a startup. I wouldn't say that trade-off is something that you should really do unless you're in a really good spot. Like, who cares? But if you're just getting into it and you have stuff to do and stuff, bills to pay, generally not the greatest environment unless you know you're confident that this company is going to grow and scale.
Makes sense. You mentioned briefly that you went down to San Francisco and were working in the Bay Area for a period of time, and then you came back. What was the adjustment like going down there? And if there was an adjustment, what was it?
Yeah. So maybe the thing that I want to talk about first is just like describing the differences between SF and Canada in particular. I think there's a lot of buzz when people talk about Silicon Valley, but when you're in the bubble of like Toronto or whatever, you don't really get the context unless you actually work there. So I think some of the immediate challenges that we usually face in Canada is the lack of investment capital. You know, industry focus in San Francisco is significantly higher than it is, I would say, in the Canadian ecosystem. And then just the access to the talent pool. That's the biggest thing. We have a lot of talent in Canada, but that talent doesn't stay in Canada. It goes down to the Valley or goes to New York or whatever. So one of the things you'll start noticing is the appetite for growth, the appetite for knowledge, the appetite for just being successful, which is kind of almost like ingrained in American culture. With any project that you're building, everyone's just focused on that kind of lifestyle. And so working down there for 2.5 years, you definitely get influenced into this idea of execution first, strategize afterwards. And this idea of getting like a lot of feedback a lot quicker, moving a lot quicker. You meet a lot more folks, you learn a lot quicker too. And I think that's kind of the particular differences in terms of how I would describe the environment in SF versus Canada in general. So infrastructure also has a play with this. A lot of Canadian companies really tend to rely on government funding to kind of stay afloat. Think of SHRED. We love SHRED in Canada. Whereas in the US, you don't really have as many programs that subsidize a lot of your costs. And so they're really relying on, we have to grow to get to that next phase. Whereas we're kind of risk adverse and we have some of those tools in the background. So I think that's one of the things I would preface when I'm kind of thinking about SF versus Canada. Specific to the role, I honestly just wanted to understand what it was in terms of, you know, America versus Canada. And I think those 2.5 years there really helped, one, build a good network in terms of, you know, individuals I can kind of lend and help or just get feedback from in the future. There's a lot of expertise down there that can really support some of the companies that we have out here in Canada. And then two, I would just say like the ability to just have a particular focus and those granular skills. So we know like entire Silicon Valley is just focusing on AI now. And so this concentration is kind of, you know, something so appealing that I think a lot of folks just don't get exposed to. And so one of the things I would love to see in Toronto specifically, and we're working towards it now, is this idea of very strong connected communities, especially with new advents of technology. We have great ecosystems like UW, the University of Toronto when it comes to AI, but how do we influence that talent to stay here? We still have to solve that. And so I think, for me, what it was is like, could I be somewhat involved in that next trend or wave of influencing folks to kind of stay in Canada, develop the ecosystem here? And so if you have more success stories within AI, then you tend to want to kind of stay here and help the local ecosystem. I would say also, though, like pay discrepancy is a huge factor in terms of why people go down south versus stay in Canada. You're on average, including how shitty our dollar is right now, you know, getting paid 30-40% higher down south, factoring even in the cost of living. So I think that's there's something that we have to change the local ecosystem But finding opportunities in Canada are much harder at like great companies versus somewhere in Silicon Valley.
There's a lot of chatter, obviously, right now about the Canadian ecosystem versus the US one. You've highlighted some of your observations. Who do you think, or why do you think someone should join a Canadian company versus an American one? And how might that change depending on their stage of career or even stage of life?
Yeah, I would say generally speaking, we have quite a bit of support in the late stage when it comes to a company actually being successful. So if you think of like tech companies that have done well, Shopify, perhaps OpenText, Verafin, these are large companies that, you know, are late stage now and pretty much corporate in terms of its entity. Where we really need to focus in on is like the early stage and promote grassroots innovation. And I just feel like where we lack again is this idea of having access to capital. We don't really have a lot of early stage capital, although we do see VCs promote the fact that, hey, we're early stage or whatever. I do feel they're still risk averse, where they're just really investing in like a Series A round where, you know, some of that risk is taken off. Whereas if you reflect on kind of what SF does it, they see the opportunity at the seed round or even pre-seed round. And so that spurs a lot of innovation. If I were to reflect on kind of if an individual wants to join a company and be a part of something big and kind of assess how they want to work at a startup, I would tend to say, hey, in Canada right now, see if you can join a company at like the Series B stage. That's where a lot of the risk has been already taken off the table. Generally, a lot of companies in Canada don't get to this point at all in the tech ecosystem. So most likely they have a good trajectory of growth and could be that rocket ship you're exploring. That's what I would say. Seed and Series A, you're looking a bit more, it's a bit more challenging for sure to get to that next stage. So depending on your risk profile and kind of what you want to do, I would say start off with Series B, at least in the Canadian ecosystem. And if you're really, really out there, go for the seed, Series A, and see how you can influence and build something.
Changing gears a little bit to a topic I believe you're passionate about and something we think a lot about at Float, and that's automation.
Yeah.
And obviously you work at a company that's deep in this space, so I imagine you have some great perspective. Where do you see the opportunity for automation to change the way finance teams work?
Yeah. So one thing I would say is like, I feel like there's a lot of fear within like this idea of AI taking over everything. I would say we're quite a bit of way in terms of AI replacing individuals specifically. I would say right now where we're at is AI is at the stage where it really helps boost productivity for a lot of individuals and kind of your workflows. So if I were to kind of apply this to finance specifically, where I see where I can kind of automate my day-to-day is at least financial analysis. There's a lot of tools out there now where I can just add a data set, a raw data set, either through an Excel, CSV, whatever, and it would automatically summarize, develop some charts, and really save me, I don't know, like 30 plus minutes of time for me to understand that level of kind of raw data or kind of manipulating it in terms of what I want to understand. So I think there's an immediate value there. There's a lot of tools out there right now. An example of that is Fluent, which we are actually exploring at Spellbook as well. And so anyone can get access to a question or answer something related to their data. One of the challenges I find finance typically has in an early stage company is you tend to be the source of all these questions. Hey, like what was our sales last week? Or hey, like what's our gross margin? So imagine the amount of time you can save if you can just, you know, prompt a kind of AI type tool where, you know, the salesperson is just typing this into that tool and they have the data readily available to them. You're saving hours and hours upon hours of time where you can kind of prioritize where you need to put in, the work in. So that's one area where we're looking at right now. I think other areas of finance is just kind of like workflow automations, specifically around just categorization and kind of record keeping. So another tool that we're exploring is called Make. So Make basically builds like this backend infrastructure, and you can kind of develop workflows through AI. So an example workflow I can give you is, I get a lot of receipts or invoices in my inbox specifically, and I generally don't want to see that because it's just going to blow up my inbox. And so how I kind of use this is developed a workflow where anything really that has a receipt will kind of go outbound in terms of like this workflow. And it has its own specific designated folder in our G Drive, and it would automatically categorize it based off of month and based off how the AI understands it. For example, is it a R&D expense? Is it like a finance expense? Is it an advertising expense? So it saves quite a bit of time in terms of month end reconciliation, record keeping, where these things are. So there's a lot of, I think, advantages when it comes to finance, specifically around the time saving piece. I don't think you'll be ever able to replace a head of finance or a VP of finance, because AI can't replace great decision making, I would say. So there is that piece. But I do feel like a few folks in the junior roles could be tend to be replaced in the long term as, you know, AI gets better, the financial tools get better. Another piece I would say is like a lot of people are pretty hyped around this idea of AI replacing auditing or these like financial ERPs that have an AI piece to it. I tend to be more pessimistic about those just because how complicated accounting is and how subjective it can be. And so if an AI is pretty much rules based, which it kind of is based on how you design it, that's really not, doesn't lend well in terms of accounting principles. So I'm kind of a skeptic in terms of those tools out there. And there's a lot of tools that have raised quite a bit of money. I've tested a few of them, and I'll just say they're not the greatest at this point in time. There's a lot of value out there. But I'd say like focus right now, if you're a finance person, on the analysis piece and just like saving yourself time if you can, by building out workflows that make everyone's life easier.
You mentioned, this idea of the head of finance not being replaced, the importance of judgment, definitely agree. Within the subject matter of the function, is there an area that you think is overrated or unlikely to benefit from automation?
We touched on it right there. I think it's really the accounting piece. It's super, super hard to replace or kind of automate a lot of the subjective style of accounting, right? If you think of it this way, like two companies can be SaaS, but they recognize revenue two different ways based off of like how they've designed the revenue recognition policies. And so can you design an AI or like a tool that can do like 1,000 different kind of styles or use cases? I really, really doubt that, because it's just going to get way too complicated. I think, again, what you can really replace is like the financial analysis side of things, or the data side, data piece of it. Typical day-to-day accounting, I really don't think you can replace it. And the head of finance role is going to be managing that for the most part. But you have like a bookkeeper or whatever, which even them, they're harder to replace. So I would say there's still a lot of roles out there for finance folks. I wouldn't fear too much right now.
Makes sense. How do you think about automation from your position as a finance leader, but just generally also a leader in a business? Is this a top-down directive or something that you think people everywhere are embracing and should be embracing day to day to improve their efficiency and productivity? Should organizations set that out top down, or is this just a core expectation that everyone should bring to work?
I'm in the belief that everyone should be bringing this to work. The reason why I say that is, especially with like the new kind of labor that's coming in, that's younger, Gen Zs and stuff like that, they tend to be a lot more focused on using a lot of these tools and technology. They also have the psychological factor where they want to build influence in a company. So when I think about building culture within the startup specifically, it does really benefit from everyone kind of collaborating and brainstorming or providing ideas. And so if you develop that culture, when we think about AI specifically or automations, get feedback from anyone within any role, you'd be surprised to see some of the minds on a lot of folks, but they just maybe tend to be shy because they don't want to speak up to a leader or stuff like that. So I think the first piece of it is really creating an environment where everyone is easygoing and can kind of bring these ideas forward. And the second being just like being receptive from the leadership level, the mid stage level, and just anywhere across the organization that, yeah, this is a good idea. Let's explore it. I think the piece where that generally gets missed across this is like, how do you effectively, like as a leader, you understand how to bring this forth and kind of implement it across the company. Generally speaking, someone who's young or like trying to bring some idea in front of you, they just bring the idea without no backing or understanding of how this is going to influence the org and stuff like that. So I think there's another level where I'm all open for the autonomy and bringing forward ideas, but you do need to develop also that culture of communication and effective lines of communication. So bring forth as much as you can. I think as AI comes more important, productivity lends itself quite a bit in terms of, you know, how fast you can scale. And all that time saving, you can obviously prioritize quite a bit. And so if you're only doing it from the top down, it's really hard to kind of influence individuals at the bottom layers to kind of work on those specific workflows. Or do they accept those specific workflows? Do they understand why we're doing them? Probably not. If you're kind of using it as a cohesion across the entire company, probably it's a good way to do it. So I would say a lot of AI companies are operating like that right now. And so it's a good sign. A lot of time saving, a lot of great gains in productivity. And perhaps even could spur an idea in your actual product as well. So everyone's trying to add AI to their tool today, right? So you never know.
That was great, Aman. Really appreciate it. This has been a fascinating conversation, a wide range of topics. So appreciate you doing this. To wrap up, let's do some rapid fire questions, if that works for you.
Sure, let's do it.
What's the craziest thing you've seen someone try to expense?
Okay, so 2 years ago, we had this offsite, which was in Vegas. So you can kind of get the idea of where this is going. We had obviously went out, we had a good dinner and stuff like that. We had a few of the sales guys do some extracurricular activities at late night. And it's kind of like that Wolf of Wall Street kind of thing, where literally next week I saw him like, hey, this looks like an adult entertainment club that you're trying to expense. And literally that's like, it was like a $5,000 bill. And we had to talk with the sales team in terms of, hey guys, this is not appropriate. If this kind of gets out, you know, a lot of people are going to be like, what the hell are you guys encouraging? So I would say like, that's the weirdest one or like the most explosive kind of thing I've seen, expensed. Obviously it wasn't approved, but, you know, there's a lot of, folks that think that's okay.
What's a podcast, conference, or other resource you recommend to our audience?
Two. So if you're a finance person, one of my favorite blogs is the Secret CFO, which is a really popular one, an amazing resource. And when it comes to anything related to podcasting, I love Lenny's podcast. Again, in the role of finance, you don't want to be that kind of that single individual just knows finance. Kind of explore different options and learn how other companies grow and how product is designed. So I would say Lenny's podcast.
And then lastly, who's a finance leader you admire?
I would say my personal favorite is Howard Marks from Oak Tree Capital. So it's not a traditional, I'd say, finance or tech person. I just really, really love his blogs or kind of memos that he writes about. And they do have a lot of influence in terms of how you think about the future of your own company. So he's definitely someone I look up to.
Legend.
Yeah.
Great memos, the quarterly letter.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
If you're listening and haven't read Howard Marks's memos, they're a real treat. Amen. Thanks so much for joining. This was a ton of fun, and I really appreciate you having you on.
Yeah, absolutely. Hope your folks love hearing what I had to say, and thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Retained Learnings. We want to reach as many Canadian finance professionals as possible. So if you have 2 minutes to spare, we'd love for you to rate and review the new show. Sharing on social media helps too, and you can tag @Flowcard. I'm Rob Kazam, and until next time, take care.